Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 110. Formative Literature Tangent Special. Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each episode we will take a look at one work of literature and determine whether or not it is required reading, except when we hit a multiple of 10. And in this case, we are doing another episode where we kind of count down some books and list some things that are favorites, etc. But as opposed to episode 100, where we talked about favorites and best in different genres, we are going to talk about formative works that are formative to us. And my lovely co-host Stella is here to help explain that. But before we do that, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing okay. Yeah, as we speak, just finished my requirements for exams, mm-hmm. and I've proctored all I need to proctor, and I've graded my exams. I have two classes filled of projects, but they're not due until later January, so I think I'll wait until I get back. But yeah, just looking forward to time with friends and family and time away from the institution to recover. So yeah. I would say mostly okay.
Yeah, me too. It's I literally, as we're recording this, I literally had my last day before break of classes. So a little burned out at the moment. Mm-hmm. So into recovery, but I'm glad that I'm here, and we're gonna have a little fun tonight, and it's nice to just go into a break like this. So
yeah
so I've been looking forward to this. So why don't you tell the audience what we're getting at when we talk about formative literature and how this is going to work tonight?
Absolutely. Yes. It should not be confused with formative assessments, which are actually, I guess one could say that there is an overlap, because with formative assessments, there's not usually a grade attached, but it's very much like a check-in to see how people are doing. And with these, I mean, the idea came about as we were throwing it around that we're sort of in a weird, I think, place and time. I think the world is a bit weird, but specifically the country that we're in, the US, feels a bit odd, and lots of negativity and bad things. And so I thought, what are some positive examples of literature that we've encountered that have really shaped us or formed us into the people that we currently are, or have helped us on our journey towards being, you know, good humans? So that really is my, like, I think the idea, that's how I formed the list as well, sort of because I think we always want to be people who are growing in knowledge as well as behavior, and never really want to be stagnant. So what are top five? This is what we picked. Five things that have really helped us push forward towards our dynamic character arcs.
All right, cool.
And I believe you're going to start
You the believe it because here. You told
yes,
me
because
I
told
was
you
going
to
be
to,
first.
And I decided to give you the first crack at this. So why don't
Thank
you go
you.
Ahead and
Oh,
get
yeah,
started.
I'll do it. And what's probably going to happen is as I say my things, Tom's going to be shifting around or deciding whatever he's going to do. I think that's what's going to happen. That's why he wanted me to go first.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually really apropos of this one that I am choosing because POTUS has just announced something called the Patriots Games, which sounds eerily similar
Isn't
to
it a
the
Tom
Hunger
Clancy novel?
Games. Oh, gosh. Yes. Was that plural, though? Is that
It's
Patriots?
Patriot Games, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And this is, I think, apostrophe S, so I'm not,
Ugh.
I didn't deep dive into it. But anyways, let's not, you know, get off track.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was ironic that that all of a sudden happened. So my number five, so I'm going to say what the number five is and then why, you know, why it has helped form me or what place it has on my journey. So it is going to be Hunger Games. I'll say the first one, but I think definitely that the trilogy by Suzanne Collins, that first one coming out in 2008. I think I really did not read it probably until maybe 2012. But the reason why this is formative for me is because of young adult literature and young adult literature, like canon and everything. It's not something that I had necessarily delved into, though. You know, as we grow up, you know, Where the Red Fern Grows, et cetera. Technically, we were reading young adult literature, but it wasn't something I was going out of my way to go and get. And this was a recommendation from one of my students at the time, a sophomore. And I thought, oh, this is, yeah, let me give this a go, and loved it. Obviously, it has the Roman and classicist themes that go on, which really spoke to me, as well as being, I think, really relevant and a warning too of, you know, how societies in general could fall in a bad way. And I like this for this helped for me for two reasons. One is that I then started really looking into more young adult literature. I don't know that I necessarily felt like, oh, poo-poo, you know, this doesn't deserve to be considered literature. It's not as great as, you know, fiction or adult literature. I don't think I ever had that necessarily, though there were people around me that felt that way. But I recognized, I think, immediately that even though it has the young adult label to it, that that did not lessen its impact or its import. So that was one of the big things. So then I started seeking out because, of course, we have so many voices that can be brought to young adult literature. I think there's a lot of freedom there, and it really speaks to our students as well. So that's something. And I've read so many great works of young adult that I love, you know, Poet X, you know, for example, any of these great things that we could pull and be like, look at this. I think you cannot snub your nose at that. So that's one of the reasons. The other one is it was a great gateway starting to read young adult literature to build relationships or foundations of relationships with my students, because I then entered a world where I could read what they were reading and I could discuss it with them. And I think that's an easy way to, or one of the ways to start connecting with your students. Relationship building is really important to me because I feel like if you don't have any sort of relationship with your student, that everything else kind of falls away. But if you have that foundation, I think even if your class is super tough or at times, you know, droll or boring, they're still going to want to engage with it because they have that relationship with you. And this was an easy way because I could just see what students were reading. Or, you know, and I would read it and then I could talk with them about it. And I think that they saw that I was interested in what they were interested in. And I was, you know, making that that jump or, you know, those steps to reach out to them. So those are the two ways that Hunger Games, I think, really helped form me into the person that I am today.
I think I've loved that novel and I've loved that series, and we've read, I think we've covered three out of the six books that are in there, and the two more recent ones, of course, and even the prequels, which, you know, you're taking a chance on prequels or sequels to something that's that beloved. It's risky, right? Because it could be, you know, something that people hate, and the two prequels have been great. What's interesting to me is this is probably the series that did make me dive a little bit more into young adult literature as well, because now I picked it up like I think around the Mockingjay had been out for a while, so I read all three of those in succession. I don't remember the year, but prior to that, like I was too old to really get into the Harry Potter books, which are really not the later ones. I guess you could qualify as YA, but they're more like tween lit. It's because they're kind of kids lit and like anyway. But I was too old. I was in college when the first ones came out, right? So it kind of just missed me. And by the time they were huge and everything, and I was adult, I was like really just not really interested. And magic and wizards and stuff doesn't really interest me anyway. But the other series that was going on when I did finally pick up the Hunger Games was the Twilight novels. And I had no desire to read that crap. And I did have at first kind of that nose in the air about not about YA Lit's existence, but about how seriously some people were taking it. Like, why don't these kids read more serious literature? And that was just a pretentious hang up of mine because, I went into college and read serious literature and after a while I was like, and I got a, whatever ego I have. And the freedom that you mentioned is really important because, as somebody who reads a lot and somebody who does like to write, the pressure that I think people have on them when it comes to serious literature, capital L, and the type of literary fiction I'm talking about that's on the shelves, it has this pressure to be like wrapped up in its own sense of importance, or it has to be tragic, or it has to be about characters who are just kind of inherently unlikable, and it's the reading level's pretentious, and some of it is so tiring to read. And the freedom that comes with young adult literature is that you can have stuff that is really sophisticated. The Hunger Games is a pretty sophisticated series of novels, if I'm being honest. But it doesn't forego the entertainment. And I think a lot of like really serious capital L literature foregoes the entertainment value because of whatever, ivory tower point the author is trying to make. And so why it kind of like got me back to reading things just for the fun of it and not because it has to be like life changing or about the human condition in a way that's so like, that again, college professor pretensions and all that. And I've been finding that in adult literature these days through categories like thrillers, for instance, and some horror genre work, right? Sometimes some smut, but stuff like that, whereas the mainstream literary world is still where it is. But you're right. I think it kind of opened up a lot for me as well. And I really do just love I love her world building, and I love like every time I read it, I love like kind of picturing the map of Pan Am and all the things that are going on it and all of the interactions with all the different parts of it. It's as you and I are both comic book people.
What?
Yeah, I know, right?
I'm
And
just kidding.
it doesn't it like kind of like set your comic book heart aflame afire because it's like, oh, this is like looking at a map of, Gotham or something and like all the different places and stuff. Like, when you read No Man's Land, and it was
Oh, yeah.
all the different areas. So like Pan Am kind of like that she kind of hooks into that too. And so I'm really curious to see if she comes up with another novel and where she goes with it from there. All right. I arranged my list, at least at the moment, kind of chronologically. So like starting like from like when we're reading books that like from when I was a child all the way up until adulthood, because I couldn't really rank them, right? So my first one, or number five, is actually poetry. And maybe this is because I've finished a poetry unit in AP a couple of months ago, and I'm starting a poetry unit in ninth grade in January, and actually used two poems by this author on the very first day because it's like, when was the last time you kids read poetry? And a lot of times they're like, never, what the heck are you talking about? So I tell them, like, this is some really good poetry, and it is geared toward children. It's kind of a twofer in terms of the title of the book because I always pair these two books together, but they are both by Shel Silverstein, and they are A Light in the Attic and Where the Sidewalk Ends. These books, when I got them in like the fifth grade, fourth and fifth grade, my copy I got, I think it was in the fourth grade because I had like surgery and my friend bought it as a get well gift. And then my sister got her copy of Where the Sidewalk Ends in 1988. And I know that for a fact because I took her copy. It's sitting in Brett's room, and my parents had written to Nancy, blah, 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 1988. So we've had these books for 30, almost 40 years. And prior to reading Shel Silverstein, poetry as it existed for me was Dr. Seuss and nursery rhymes, like that sort of stuff. And not that Dr. Seuss isn't sophisticated. I always point out that Robert Frost stopping by woods in a snowy evening has the exact same meter as Green Eggs and Ham. But yeah, it's whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. I do not like them on a train. I do not like them in a anyway.
Interesting.
But A Light in the Attic and Where the Sidewalk Ends was like more sophisticated. It is very, very silly. It seemed a little more adult's not the word, but it seemed a little more mature, older, or that I was reading something that wasn't just for like that wasn't just kind of like baby, you know? Not that we don't love the Grinch or whatever, but it felt a little older for me when I was in the fourth grade, right? And it really got me liking poetry. And on and off over the years, I've really gone deep in like reading a lot of poetry, and there were years where I just kind of, it was kind of on the periphery of what I was reading. But there are some hilarious poems in there. There's the one about the girl and the pancakes, and she's like, I'll take the one in the middle at the end. There's Sarah Sylvia, Cynthia Stout will not take the garbage out. And then there's two poems that are absolutely beautiful. One is called, it's in the light in the attic, it's called Invitation, and it's like it's a very short poem, and it's like, if you're a dreamer, a doer, et cetera, come in. And the illustration, because Silverstein illustrated the book too, is just this candle, and it's this great, pretty short poem. And then the actual poem, Where the Sidewalk Ends, is this beautiful poem about childhood and innocence and adults recapturing it. And it has this phrase, to cool in the peppermint wind. And I just, every time I use that in class, I'm just taken back to when I was a kid and what these images meant to me and how I've been able to pass some of this along. And I gravitate toward poetry that seems very real or it seems that I can relate to, which, duh, like people gravitate toward what they can relate to. So again, not sophisticated poetry for sophisticated poetry's sake. And I have quite a few collections of poetry on my bookshelf. And I want to say this is where it started. And I've written some terrible poetry over the years.
The vomitus.
Oh, yes, the vomit poem. But I really haven't written any real poems lately. But I have friends who are poets. I have a friend who's a published poet. And yeah, and I think the origin point for that is Shel Silverstein. So I had to put that on this list.
Lovely. Well, I will say that this origin story seems like your sister's villain origin story because you frequently do say that she doesn't return your books. And so it's probably just to get you back at you not returning her book way back when. So you really only have yourself to blame.
Probably.
yes, no, I have fond memories of Mr. Silverstein. And whenever I'm walking and the sidewalk ends, I do think of that repeatedly. I would not be able to pull out any poems, I don't think, but I do recall reading those and found much joy out of them.
All right, Stella, what's next?
Yeah, my next one is a, well, my next two will be a comic, which again, I really was not considering. I thought it was going to be all nonfiction. And then as I was editing the previous episode and Tom said, well, it doesn't have to be. I thought, oh no. And then it sent me into a tizzy. And so my list drastically
I
changed.
blew everything up, and then
He
you were
really
just
did.
crashing out.
Yes. So this is Batgirl Year One. by Chuck Dixon and Scott Beatty, and art by Marcos Martín. And the reason why this is formative is because, I guess, for two reasons again, but one is connected to the other. So it's really, it cemented my love of Barbara Gordon, because I've so fell in love with this tale and so fell in love with Barbara Gordon and her character, and really related to her character, that I then decided to dedicate 15 plus years of my life, I've completed it's sweet 16 tomorrow after this recording. And that's dedication, that's passion for a particular character, and to have it all stem from this one book, I think really speaks to that. This 9-issue miniseries that came out 2009, I believe. I guess all of my things are kind of around the same time. Not all of them. And so the podcast, obviously, but the podcast has really been something that has been life-changing, which is, of course, the secondary title of this, in that it has helped me, I think, become a better speaker. It's helped me be able to analyze things better, more closely look at things and consider before I'm speaking out about it, and considering all angles. It's created this friendship circle that has lasted, well over a decade. I wouldn't be on this show if I hadn't read Batgirl Year One, in my opinion. And it's also helped me advocate for myself, which I think is connected to that speaking role, because giving myself the opportunity to speak, I'm speaking to myself, but people are listening. It's opened up, I think, the possibility that, people are wanting to hear what you think. Whereas normally, and I think, Tom might be similar to I kind of sit back and let other people, talk and have a conversation. Usually in faculty meetings and things like that, I don't speak unless I really feel like I have something worthwhile to say.
I'm checking my watch.
And so now I just feel like I can advocate for myself, because I feel like I do have something worthwhile to say. And I think a lot of that is because of podcasting, which then goes back to this particular book. So yeah, it really has changed my life in many avenues.
I have the Robin Year One, Batgirl Year One,
oh yeah,
two in one trade. And I actually didn't read those until like sometime in the 2010s or something, because I picked it up. And both of those are great. And I mean, even just down to the art style, which reflects those, like, the whimsy of those characters in some way. But I've been a listener of your show, I don't think for the full 15 years. I think I came in around like maybe 10 or 11 years ago. But yeah, I completely see how all of that is like that. It's a great book, and mm-hmm. I'm very grateful for your show and all of that, because we met because of you doing the podcast.
Absolutely. Yep.
So yeah.
It's crazy. I know people have this weird connection between, is it Twilight and 9/11 or something, or like Dakota? I don't, there's something, like, yeah, some, you know what I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like a weird, like, Twilight to something else to Dakota Johnson. I don't know. But it really is like, it's a lot of these connecting things that, yeah, this, I don't think this podcast would exist, or at least not in this form. You might've found, somebody else. But yeah, it's a lot of things have to happen in order for something big to happen, I think.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to go up next, kind of moving in time out of childhood into college.
Whoa.
So I have poetry. I do have a comic book, but that's a little later on. It's the only work of fiction on this. This one and the next one are both nonfiction. This is actually a work of philosophy. And I may completely mispronounced the title, because you know my record on pronouncing titles, but it is Nicomachean Ethics by Aristotle.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is that this was One of the first works I read in college, famously the first one is the Iliad, and I threw it across the room. But but I was in the same class. So I was in this honors program at Loyola, Maryland, which is where I got my undergrad degree. And it was it encompassed like all the humanity, the core humanities, and you took it over 4 semesters. And the first semester was the ancient world. It was taught by a classics professor. The second one was the medieval world, the Middle Ages, and that was taught by a history professor. The third one was called the Renaissance of the Modern. I think it was an English professor. And the fourth one was the Modern World, was taught by a philosophy professor. And our classics professor, Dr. Miola, had us read the Iliad, had us read the Aeneid, but also like a bunch of Plato, like the Phaedo Symposium. I remember reading that, and some Sophocles, et cetera, et cetera, Euripides. But we had to read not all of Nicomachean Ethics, but a good portion of it. And then I had to reread it in a political philosophy class down the road. So I've read it twice, and I just, the thing, it's one of those things that, like, you know, when you go to college, your mind shifts or your mind opens in the way of the way you think about things in the world. And Aristotle's idea of that there is an ideal mean between two extremes of your ethics and values and behavior has stuck with me for 30 years. It's not my religion, so to speak, or anything like that. I don't know if I adhere to any specific political philosophy or anything aside from, you know, I tend to be very liberal. And I was raised, religiously speaking, I was raised Lutheran. But I don't know, this spoke to me as something to really consider and follow, especially since the ideal value or virtue, it was virtues, the virtues, was magnanimity, you know, being magnanimous. And it's almost like undefined in his eyes, or it's like almost hard to achieve. And the idea that you're constantly trying to achieve finding that mean throughout your life and your choices and things. And he delves into things like relationships and stuff. And the copy I had was like, got so well worn. And there were times where was confused by everything, and there were times they're not. But, you know, I had never really read philosophy. This was one of my first cracks at it. And it just, it spoke to me, and it made me interested in other aspects of philosophy. But that whole idea as something to just kind of hold on to as you went through life of, like, you know, what are you trying to achieve? And is, you know, is it where it should be between those two extreme behaviors? Not the median, but the mean, because the mean is the average. So it might be on one side or the other. But yeah, so that's, it's just, I just, when I think about books that made me or were formative or life changing, Aristotle is, was really the first, because we ended up reading The Republic, and I ended up reading, you know, God, Machiavelli, Hobbes, Locke, Sartre, like all the philosophers. But this one I kept coming back to. So I would keep coming out to The Prince, but that's only because it's entertaining. But this was, you know, this spoke to me in a way I didn't expect. And so that's why I found it formative.
Yeah. And I knew of Aristotle, knew, you know, a little bit about the golden mean through various, I think, history and classics classes in university, but I hadn't read a portion of it until last year, because I did a little philosophy unit with my Latin threes, and I will read that portion again. And I really liked it, and I think that it's something that resonates with the student. I think it did get them to think about it, that there are these extreme behaviors, and you might think that this is really good, but actually you're like, this is too much, you probably need to bring it back. You and I always talk about empathy and how empathy can become, you know, toxic if you're just giving and giving and giving of yourself, then it's going to be really harmful for you in the long run. So there is kind of a mean in that. So yeah, I can absolutely appreciate that. Do you feel like you use that in your everyday life?
I do. I can't like tally how much I do. either in finding the meaning or even in contemplating or examining something before reacting. When I think about issues of the world and approaches to things, my problem is that I overthink everything. And that's an anxiety response. But no, I think I do, because I think the idea of contemplating it and seeing, because if you think about the global meaning, it forces you to look at both sides of the thing and look at the whole, right? So I think that's a big part of it. Like, you know, and how does it affect your relationships with people and the world and things like that? Yeah, so I say I will, I do. And sometimes maybe I don't even consciously realize I'm doing it.
Have you seen Inside Out 2?
No, I really need to.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you a question about anxiety, but...
You could ask me a question about anxiety anyway.
Well, no, I just wondered if you... Well, you'll have to watch it if you feel like she's portrayed well. I felt like she was, but I would be interested in hearing what you have to say.
I'm going to give it a look when I get the chance.
Yeah. Yeah, and I will say Plato's Republic, I love pulling out his virtues in the state versus virtues in the... I always love to point out virtues and things like that. So, because, I mean, if our ideal... as teachers, really, as, again, you know, this whole episode is about how were we formed, or how are we forming ourselves to be good humans as teachers. I think there's such an enormous responsibility on us in order to help further the growth of good humans. And so having these sorts of philosophical works being brought up in the classroom, I think is really great to get them to consider it. And that even though it's happening, you know, however many years ago, hundreds, thousands, it is still relevant, and it's something that we should consider living our lives by.
Yeah. I love the allegory of the cave
too. Oh yeah. Remember, did you ever read Morning Glories?
No.
By Image Comics? Okay. Just wondered.
No. Maybe I could... That might... Libby has a lot of Image Comics trades. Maybe I'll check that out. Well, I your point about it still being relevant despite being thousands of years old, you know, considering that I've just finished teaching the Odyssey, you know, and pointing out the relevance of this work in terms of the way the story is told. And the elements of storytelling that trace their way back to Homer and et cetera. And I'm doing Shakespeare, I'm doing Macbeth, right? And I pointed out the other day that, like, you know, Macbeth slowly goes crazy over the course of the play. He goes mad and he becomes a tyrant whose power is starting to slip from him. So he holds on and becomes more tyrannical and maniacal. That's not relevant these days at all. So the relevance of literature. So we have each done two, so we're up to our third choice. Stella,
what's your third choice? Tis I, my second and final comic. And this one's like a bit rough, like how I'm gonna navigate talking about it, but hopefully people listen with good faith and I'll do the best. So it's gonna be Batwoman. Batwoman the character, Batwoman specifically by Greg Rucka and J.H. Williams. I think beginning with 52, the weekly series. And then Elegy, that ran into Detective Comics between 2009 and 2010. And I think really maybe hitting its climax with the new 52 Batwoman. So all of that. So I will say, more as an explanation and not an excuse, that I very much was in a white, cis, het-centric world. That was just like where I was going to school. The people that like... I surrounded myself with, either by choice or not by choice. Those are just like the people that were around me. So my worldview was rather small and shallow. But comics, you know, especially through college, but it was really my fifth and final year at university, that my worldview through comics really started to expand. And so in particular, I'm choosing Batwoman because I think like sexual orientation was certainly something that, you know, my Christian side of myself, right, was more legalistic back then, like, oh, you know, hate the sin but love the sinner, that sort of thing.
Yeah, okay.
Right. And, yeah. But also not really having any sort of knowledge or experience with anyone that would consider themselves on the queer spectrum, any interaction with any queer media gave me like a bad feeling. Because, and I've only really more recently, I think within maybe the past 10 years or so, realized why I felt uncomfortable, because it was all like girls making out at parties, girls making out, you know, on a like a street racing course, which was less about the emotional investment of the two and more like about titillation. Mm-hmm. And once I like encountered Kate for the first time, I was like, what's this about? Who is this person? And here we have an actual person that is not being thrown into sort of a pornographic role, and obviously was just a person. She just had, you know, an identity that was different than my own. And then seeing her in Elegy, and especially in New 52, and having that relationship in New 52 with Maggie Sawyer, and the beauty of that, and how it was portrayed. Like all of these things, you know, 2009 and 2010 and, you know, up to, I guess, 2012 was when New 52, I was like, oh, wow. Like this is, I've been constantly told, you know, that this is all like a bad thing and these are bad people. Or I'm getting this imagery of what this is. It's to serve sort of the male gaze and that sort of thing. But that's actually not at all what it is like. And so obviously now I'm like a, you know, a completely different person, very much an ally, loving all queer media. You should go out and see Heated Rivalry, and honestly oftentimes looking for great queer media, like Women Loves Women. I'm reading a WLW romance novel right now, and just the beauty of it, that I think people, once they get past, I think, you know, the bigotry and also the pornography and male gazy side of it, just get to see that there are people like all of us, right? They're just people, and I think there's also just such a beauty, in particular with, I think, women loving women, just like this softness. But Kate was very much the one that started, you know, broadening my horizons and breaking out from this like cishet world that I was living in. And so I'm ever so appreciative of that character and how well Greg Rucka and J.H. Williams, two men, dealt with, you know, that character and her arcs and things like that. So hopefully I spoke well enough.
No, yeah.
You kind of get an understanding, yeah. But I think we're all on, you know, journeys with different things. If we could all be thrown in and we're completely evolved and we're all anti-racist and pro all the positive things, that'd be great. But we're all on our journeys, especially if you grow up in a particular environment where you don't have any of those experiences. So that's why my number three and how formative and, also it's been great being in this school that is so queer friendly as well, and being able to support my students and things like that. So very much Kate, I think, is someone that I can thank for that, even though, you know, she's a fictional character.
Yeah. You have a good point about how lesbian characters, I'd say through the late 90s into maybe the mid 2000s to the late 2000s, it was very male gaze. You know, it was very like, when it hit mainstream, it was still like, the phrase used to be lipstick lesbians or lesbian chic, and like that whole thing where it's basically two hot blonde women making out, or like kind of like, you know, I don't know, there's just, it was very like for male fantasy and not showing the genuine aspects of anything. And I did read the book. I think I have the Elegy trade downstairs, and I read 52, and I read the New 52 thing all the way up until once J.H. Williams quit, I left the book as well, because he was going to marry Kate and Maggie, and I think it was Dan DiDio
who said no.
And I was just like, well, I'm not going to read this book anymore, because that would have been amazing to see, you know? And we've had some, we've had some good queer representation on superhero shows in recent years, Supergirl especially.
Oh yeah, 100%.
You know, so and the Batwoman show is not the Batwoman show was fun to watch. It got pretty bad toward the end of it, but I did enjoy watching it. But no, that's a great pick, and it's a great story too. It's really cool. Thanks. how that did. All right. My next one has to do, it's another work I read in college. And it has to do with like me as an aspiring writer/writer, because of who the author is and what I liked to write at the time where I read him, and it really inspired me. It is an anthology, and it is the essays of E.B. White. E.B. White, of course, wrote Charlotte's Web and mm-hmm. The Trumpet of the Swan, Stuart Little, but he was an essayist. Into the Atlantic, Harper's, New Yorker, etc. And this is a collection of his essays, some of the better ones. And his style was very easy but sophisticated. His topics were very everyday. Now, he lived in New York City, but he also lived up in Maine and in Florida. So a lot of it had to do with kind of like, you know, looking, observing the world around him, the natural world, or not in the kind of like, you know, nature writer type of way, but like, you know, what was going on around him and things like that. But he would also write about some of the things that were important during the time. And, you know, he was writing mostly in like, you know, the war era and then the post-war era. And he's got some wonderful pieces. Here Is New York is a lengthy essay of his that is just this walk through New York in the early 1950s. It's like a Valentine to it with a real realistic view of it. Afternoon of an American Boy is a really kind of cute clapback against McCarthy. Mm. Farewell, My Lovely is a tribute to his Ford Model T because, you know, the like Sears stopped selling the parts or something. Once More to the Lake, probably my favorite of his essays, is him taking his son to the same lake in Maine where he used to vacation as a child, staying in the same cabins and that sort of thing. And the whole time he's comparing it to when he was younger, but it's also the bond between parents and children and the way you see yourself in your child and the way you realize your own in some places or mortality, like, you know, it's this beautifully written, but it's like such a simple little story, but there's something there beyond that. And at the time I read it, I was a freshman in college the first time I read it, and I read it again in my junior year. I believe I took an entire course on E.B. White. It's called The Art of Prose. So I read the essays of E.B. White as well his collection, which was called One Man's Meat. And I was writing a column in the student newspaper at the time, which was very slice of life / attempted humor. And I kind of always looked at his stuff and was like, I would love to be able to write this. And, you know, if I've been blogging on and off for the last 25 years here and there, and sometimes write stuff about pop culture and stuff, but sometimes write essays about life and very kind of observational things. And I come from a very privileged background, if I'm being completely honest. You talked about coming from a very cis white background. You know, I've like, yeah, I'm the whitest guy who ever whited. You know, I mean, I'm cis and het, and it's just like I'm a like just the rubber stamp of every other white suburban guy who grew up in a nice neighborhood and never had to worry about much. So like, you know, so writing about my pain is not exactly a topic, but I can do observational things and things like that. And he just always inspired me. And I will go back to his essays every once in a while just to get that feeling again. And also his writing style is wonderful. So somebody who inspires you and like somebody you look up to as a writer can be very, very formative in that way.
Is this person still alive?
E.B. White?
Yeah.
No, he died in 1985.
Oh, okay.
No. Yeah.
Why do you say it like that? As well, if I we... should know? Did you say that this person passed away when you were talking?
No, no, no.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering. I was like, oh, maybe Tom could write.
No.
You know?
We'll have a Fault in Our Stars moment where the guy's like a total jerk.
Oh, no. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so.
Well, that's lovely.
Thank you.
And then where would you say you are on your writer's journey?
Well, I have two podcasts, one of which I keep bonking on making another episode. It's not this one. I have blogged. Yeah. Oh, for so long. Well, I've had Pop Culture David as a blog for what? Since 2012. And before that, I had another one that I took down because I had finished it and I was paying for the domain name and everything. So I was like, well, if I'm not going to keep writing this, I'm going to take it down. And I go back to like the days of LiveJournal and those sorts of things. But right now, I haven't written a lot of essays lately, aside from like kind of little blog posts here and there. Although I've written a few over on the Uncollecting about finding old stuff of mine and like reflecting on it. So I guess that's pretty close to it. I've been writing a lot more fiction.
Oh yeah.
I got back into writing fiction because friends of mine asked me to join a writing group. So I've written like 3 short stories in the last year and just completed the first draft of a novel. So I'm pretty doing it, you know, but as far as being published, I've had like one essay published like years and years ago in an online journal is about the perils and horrors of 7th grade chorus class. Finally, like being the nerdy kid and being picked on, and chorus class was just the worst place for it when I was in junior high school.
Why anyway. Chorus class?
You know, they kind of shoved this all into there, and the people I was with just were just jerks. It's just, I just have really bad memories. And I have some bad memories of like the teachers too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, anyway.
Thanks.
All right. Each of us has 2 more. So, what is your penultimate?
Yes, a really big one. Somewhat connected to the previous one and that, you know, human rights issues. But it's going to be stamped from the beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America by Ibram X. Kendi, which came out in 2016. And I think I read it in 2020, because when I read it, I recall being at a UVA oncology clinic and being one of their COVID screeners. So that's what it was. So yes, connected, I think, to I was gonna say queer awakening. My queer awakening as in the sense of understanding, you know, that, you know, other people, etc. I feel like I don't know if I would consider myself an anti-racist necessarily. I was just someone who is, I think, moving through the world trying not to have prejudice necessarily, and recognizing that there were definitely issues that were happening in our world. Recognize that someone who had a different color skin than I did would move through the world differently and would have a different life experience. I think I knew all of this definitely like in the abstract, and also, you know, slavery was a bad thing. It was hard, you know, and it really continued at Jim Crow, like all of these things, right? But as I was reading Stamped from the Beginning, it moved from this abstract idea to, wow, it really is seated in like nearly everything in this particular country, I will at least say. And also very eye-opening in terms of, well, there were certainly some things that we skipped over in history class in U.S. American history. Well, I didn't have to say U.S. American. In U.S. history. In particular, some like wide-opening things about Ronald Reagan in particular, the New Deal and how there were things like surreptitiously kind of slipped in there. So all of these were very eye-opening because you hear that, you know, what this country is sort of made up of and the long legacy of racism and white supremacy. And again, like, I think you have an, if you're open, if you're, you know, a willing person, you could be like, oh yeah, I get it. But once you are hit in the face with the facts, I don't think you really recognize how, like I said, thoroughly, I think, threaded in the bedrock of our country it is. And really, I think that was the transitional period. Again, it seems late, but really better late than never, huh? Of more becoming less of like, I'm not prejudicial, to being more proactively, you know, anti-racist and what that exactly looks like. And re-examining different things and maybe, you know, how you are interacting with different people, things that might seem innocuous and, oh, well, this actually has kind of a bad view, you know, from a different perspective, like little things like that, especially in the healthcare world, right? Because, you know, people are treated differently. And then you start to ask questions as to why, like, where's this coming from? So lots all that. And then that was also, I would say, the catalyst to me looking at a whole slew of other books. White Fragility, I was looking at. I was looking at, oh no, I've lost it. That one book that's about redlining and
The Color of Law.
Thank you. Yes, The Color of Law. Just like trying to get everything that I could in order to learn more about it. Colorism, learning more about that, texturism, you know, some things that I didn't realize really the extent of it. And yeah, so it has very much, I think, pushed me forward on a different path. And obviously being a white person, you spoke of privilege, Tom. We do have this privilege just because of our skin color and recognizing that, because thinking of my white privilege or being white was not necessarily something that I was doing. But now I kind of check myself sometimes depending on, you know, the space that I'm in. And also, you know, currently I am the upper school DEI coordinator working with the office. So I'm hopeful that, you know, one of those reasons is because, you know, I'm continually trying to self-educate and push myself forward and better understand things. So yeah, I think primarily it was just moving these points of knowledge from the abstract into like reality of, oh wow, I had no idea. Because you think it's just moments in time, like these big explosive mm-hmm. moments when slaves first landed, slavery, Civil War, you know, Reconstruction, Jim Crow. And you think, oh, it's okay. You know, we're told when we elected Obama, we're in a post-racist, we're right. But I just don't think that exists, which, you know, look at it now. So, yeah, it's just I really love Kendi as a writer. And I think sometimes you have to take really hard stuff, because I wonder if some people are like, oh, it's too intense for me. But I like to have kind of intense things and be like, this is all true. And you kind of have to reconcile who you are and how you've lived with the facts that you are facing with. So, yeah, big stuff.
Yeah, I've read it as well. I've also read Stamped, which was mm-hmm. the young adult version that he did with Jason Reynolds.
Right.
And I had a lot of the same thoughts that you did while I was reading it. I did read The Color of Law, by the way, which was outstanding.
Yep.
And I grew up in a not only just a very white middle class place. It was both actively and, I don't know if this is a good phrase for it, like passively racist. Like people weren't outwardly behaving that way because there weren't very many black people in the town where I lived. So you'd have cousins or people who told like off
right?
Off jokes, like racist jokes and stuff, and like, ha ha ha, look how racy I'm being. Teachers would make racist comments at my school about different things, or but they would be very, they would be couched not in like outward N-word type of stuff, but like couched in statements about something or debate, quote unquote, kind of in the same way we see it these days with people who just try to, like, you know, skirt the fact that they're being racist and would be so offended if you said that, you know, you are being racist. So that was a lot of my upbringing. And, you know, I've gone on a similar journey in some cases. I liked Kennedy's book. I thought in some cases he got a little too long-winded, if I'm being honest. And there were some times where I thought he got kind of wrapped up in his own terminology, but that's like nitpicking. What I would like, I don't think in the media we saw enough dialogue about these things. We saw a lot of like push and then push back and push and push back. There wasn't a lot of conversation going on, which is unfortunate, but you never see that in the media these days. It's always people yelling at each other. And I think this is it's a great book to help open that conversation too. Mm-hmm. It is a tome.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so
but I mean, it goes through all of history.
So. Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right about the history and how it's like all we know from history is like little moments of things based on whatever. Yeah. And God, the post racist thing, even in 2009, when they started using that word all the time, I couldn't stand the word because I was like, you're just rushing to make fetch happen here.
Oh,
you want to be the guy who coined the term because you want that headline or whatever. And it was just too, not that I wasn't optimistic when Barack Obama got elected, but I was like, you're jumping the gun here.
Oh, you mean post-racist? I thought you were talking about
anti. No, post-racist, yeah. That whole thing, yeah.
It was also interesting just because certain things, which then, you know, it leads you to a rabbit hole. Things like Flint, Michigan.
Yes.
Or Hurricane Katrina. Like either natural disasters or in the case of Flint, Michigan, was more of like a treatment.
The lead and the, yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff. You feel like, well, these are like really unfortunate events. But then it's like tied to, you know, races, which is, it's nuts. Yeah, because you just have to dig deeper and you're like, wow, it's really threaded there. Or if you think about transportation, Atlanta, for example, or even here in Baltimore, because the light rail only goes north and south. It doesn't go east to west, which is where the Black Butterfly is, which is where the predominantly people of color, those neighborhoods. So yeah, it's just nuts how it's like, it really is threaded in there. Yeah. So
Well, I've read Robert Caro's The Power Broker, which is a biography of Robert Moses. And if you want to talk about redlining and bulldozing neighborhoods and all that other stuff, you know, there's your guy. So, yeah. All right. Okay. My next one is my comic book for this. We're going to get, and actually this is a comic book that really did change my perspective on some things, both in terms of entertainment, how comics are read, and then actually sexuality. It's going back to what you were talking about, Kate Kane.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff. This one, though, was a very long series for a long time. So it's like,
oh, I know what we're talking about.
Yeah. So it's going to be Terry Moore's Strangers in Paradise. So I had heard of this because I used to get the previews catalog, like all the way back in like high school, you know, when I, from my local comic shop, because I had a pull list, and I would see, because, you know, you remember the days of flipping through previews probably, maybe. And like there was the DC section, the Marvel section, Image, but then like behind that was all like the individual indie publishers, right? You know, the one-off people, like Terry Moore Abstract Studios would be there. And for a while he was working with Image. And I remember seeing this title and I remember looking kind of interesting, but through my teen and college years, all I was reading was superhero comics with the occasional like Star Wars or Aliens comic thrown in. So independent comics for me up until about 2001 or two, when I first started reading this, was like what Dark Horse was putting together for intellectual property stuff, you know, Star Wars. DC had Star Trek for the still had Star Trek and that sort of thing. So I wasn't really buying anything like Strangers in Paradise. And then a friend of mine from way back in DC, Paul, huge comic geek as well, and he was like, he had like way more than I did, and he would just kind of give me stuff. And he started me with Neil Gaiman's Sandman, which I had read bits and pieces of over the years and everything. But then he started me on Strangers in Paradise with the very first trade. And I read up until that point, I think he more was on like book 11, and then from or book 10 or 11. And from book 10 or 11 on, I just bought the trade every time it came out. And if you're unfamiliar with Strangers in Paradise, it is basically the story of these two women, Francine and Katina Chuvanowski, or Kachu, who live in, I think it's Austin. Is it Austin or Houston? They live in Texas, and I think it's Houston, either one. And it's very much a rom-com in many places, but it's also ends up being this like action thriller type of story because Kachu's secret past comes back to haunt her, and she used to be this like kind of high-end escort slash like mafia doll. It's this like, you know, this woman named was it Darcy?
Gosh.
Parker. Yeah, she's one of the
Yeah.
Parker girls, which was
Parker
basically like
Girls.
corporate espionage and political intrigue. And the past is coming back to haunt her, and they get involved with David, who's her brother. And it's a soap opera in a big way, right? And Moore is funny as hell, and he writes women very, very well. And the two of them are in love with each other, and you're just waiting for years for these two to get together. And he's done sequel series and everything like that. So for me, this was my first foray into this type of comic book. You know, the idea that you didn't need like the spandex set. It also was like Moore draws women beautifully, but he draws women very realistically. And so, as opposed to if I'm over at, you know, looking at what was popular in the 90s, which were like anatomically impossible women, like were their digestive systems inside their breasts because their breasts were so huge, but their waists were so small. And this sort of over-sexualization. And here, like Moore had a story that was beautiful, lovely, sweet, and sexy at times, and like kept you riveted. And I was like, oh, comics can be like this. And I think it's the formative work because it's what opened me up to comic books and graphic novels that had nothing to do with superheroes. So I would go on to read Blankets. We talked about Blankets, Persepolis, The Waiting Place by Sean McKeever and Mike Norton. I just met Mike Norton at the Baltimore Comic Con. It's a coming of age thing I absolutely love. Nothing Better, which was what we covered, the college one we covered by Tyler Page years ago. I mean, those sorts of things. I'm always seeking them out when they look really, really interesting. And my kid, kid, they're 18. Aside from Spider-Man, a lot of Spider-Man, a lot of Venom and Carnage and that sort of stuff, and Godzilla. But like Brett has almost all of Lumberjanes and has read all of Heartstopper, read well, he read they read the Amulet series, you know, that's by Kazushi. So like they've discovered at a much younger age the potential that graphic novels and comics have to tell stories that you could still see on TV and in novels that don't have to have action and superheroes. And you know, I love Strangers in Paradise for it. I've reread it a couple of times since then. I've gotten Terry Moore to sign all 19 trades at this point. Woohoo. And still
Cool.
buy his stuff. Like still buy his stuff. And we've both met him a couple of times. He's the nicest guy. But yeah, this was a formative work for me because it took my comics reading in a much different direction than where it was at the time. And I still read superheroes. Don't get me wrong, but it really opened my world.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, going back to Kate and really anyone else, trans characters as well. That I think comics just have this ability to be more progressive earlier and maybe push it forward a bit more than other forms of media. And so, yeah, that was so lovely. So I've read all of this as well, all of Strangers in Paradise, and I still love to see them because he has this whole universe, so you get to see them frequently. And yeah, it certainly is not an easy road for either of them, because Francine seems like she's straight for a while, but is also like struggling with whatever, you know, feelings that she has for Kachu. And then you have, yeah, David and that whole situation.
Yeah.
It's an intense melodrama that you really, you get into with all of these crazy people. What's that blonde girl's name who's nuts?
Casey. Casey's like the bubbly, yes, big boob blonde. Yes. And then there's like Tambi, who's like the muscular. And I think they're like in love with each other.
They are in love with each other now, which is like the perfect oddball couple for them. Yeah. But again, you know, written by a man. And yeah, I know several men who love that. That story, and I feel like this is not a titillation kind of thing, but it very much based in emotion and the beauty of relationships. So and then
there's Freddie Femer, who like is just the torture boy of the whole thing. He's such a scumbag.
I don't know how he's able to pull all these attractive women though.
But no, it's such a it's such a great series. All right, you got one left.
The number one.
What's number one?
Number one. Yeah, it's a bit of a cheat because probably my number one on the previous episode, but it is going to be Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. So I guess I don't know if I could think of a list she wouldn't be on there, and I was just talking about with Jane with somebody else today. But the reason why this is number one is because any of the remainders on this list, 2 through 5 or, you know, 2 through infinity, would not happen, I think, without Jane Eyre, because Jane Eyre was very much what sparked my love of reading. When I was younger, my mother made me read 60 minutes a day, which seemed like a chore. There were times that I was very resentful of this because I was called from outside and I had to read, a chapter book. Often those abridged versions of the classics like Tom Sawyer. They're very specific.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about. And then, of course, you get to middle school, high school. You have required reading, trademark Tom and Stella, and you know, you lose a bit of it sometimes, I think, of a love of reading because of the requirements that come with it, which is like the greatest sort of conundrum of, as a teacher, how do we continue a love of reading, you know, when there are these requirements? How do we prevent students from hating what they're reading? And then college, you know, I didn't really have a lot of time, but you know, Rory Gilmore and my love of Gilmore Girls and having that list made and starting to read it, was like, yeah, I'm gonna get through the greats, you know, these things that people really talk about. And once I hit Jane Eyre, it was just like something really beautiful opened up inside me, just with the language. That it's a difficult novel, but I was able to make my way through it with, you know, a modicum of understanding, because sometimes, you know, people shut down with tough novels. You know, I've probably done that as well when I was younger, but to have that grit and like make your way through difficult language and take your time and try to figure out what's going on. And then the character of Jane herself, and just being someone that I really love. If I had not read that, maybe, you know, something else would have struck. Element OP, which I absolutely love, that could have been something. But I think it really was Jane Eyre that started. I was like, wow, you know, reading can be intense. It can be difficult, but it's so worthwhile. And that's, I think, really what gave me my passion to continue reading. And so the things that are on this list would maybe not have happened, or would have happened later. I wouldn't be doing the show with you. I wouldn't have, you know, hundreds of, you know, books that I've, you know, read each year, or 100, you know, as a goal to read each year, and really love and engage with students again. So everything's sort of wrapped up, I think, in Jane Eyre. She is the catalyst.
All right. Yeah. It's funny because I'm not surprised you mentioned it. I actually deliberately went for books that I hadn't mentioned before.
Oh, yeah.
Because like my kind of eye-opening novel, of course, I talked on a previous episode, was It. for various reasons. But no, yeah, Jane Eyre, I have such a love-hate relationship with the Brontes to begin with that,
For sure.
but I totally see where you're going, and I completely appreciate that because it does, because then it, you know, because you, it takes you off into like directions that, you know, where you, like you said, you wouldn't be where you are now if you, as far as a reader and somebody who likes to talk about literature, if you hadn't started somewhere in Jane Eyre, like providing that catalyst in a big way. And yeah, I've heard the whole from people who are quote experts in the field condemning English teachers for assigning reading because you kill the love of reading. I've like literally heard people say that, and I'm like standing with both fingers raised in their general direction because it's just like, you know, because you want somebody to read something like Jane Eyre because it's challenging to them, or because it will make them think or take them out of their box or whatever, or it's a good story that you want them to read and contemplate, right? The same way we want them to read The Great Gatsby, or I'm only going to say it because the spine of it's staring me right in the face right now, like, you know, Moby Dick, and things like that. Like, you know, this is older literature. It's harder to read, but like, you know, the challenge is there. And it's so, you know, for as much as I like did and did not like Jane Eyre, it is a very rich novel. And there is a lot to discuss, and a lot, it would not be where it is right now had it not been so rich and had so much depth to it. Yeah. All right, I guess I'll take us home. You talked about Ibram Kendi's Stamp from the Beginning. This is along the same lines in terms of like showing a different perspective on history and like really changing my mind as to really looking at like what history is and how it's told. The book is called Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Whoa,
It's
tell
by
me.
James Loewen, who passed away a few years ago. And I've read two editions of it because there was an edition he published in the late 90s, and then he published some in like the 2000s, 2010s, updated. It is all about how history textbooks for, especially for high school, I was a high school teacher, I think, so he focused on high school history textbooks. It's all about how terribly they're written and what they leave out and what they get wrong. And how that happens, but then it gets into the truth behind certain things happening. So, like, it's actually where I learned that Helen Keller had a prolific career as a writer and an advocate and a and like a somebody who had philosophical essays published and things like that. Because all I knew of Helen Keller was like from like what you remember from like The Miracle Worker. You
Sure.
know, she was blind. And then he went to Columbus. He went to when in this in the later edition he goes into like how the books quote teach 9/11 and like, you know, why is our history curriculum written so terribly? And he's not blaming teachers. I think that the title's provocative, but he's clearly looking at like here's these publishers and this is what they're doing, and it's not, this is why people don't know enough of their history. So if you go to Kendi, who's talking about here's all the stuff that you never learned in high school, it's because Loewen's kind of explaining one of the reasons why, which is it has racism and it's and homophobia and sexism and misogyny and also like looking down on the poor and in some cases like just jingoism in it. Like those all figure into it as well. And it was, and it's a slim read. It's a couple few hundred, a couple hundred pages, so it was there, and that actually from there. Having read that, I'm like, oh, this is fascinating. And it made me think of how I was taught history and the ways I was taught, how everybody else was taught, right? You know, just like these little snippets and things, a mile wide and an inch deep. But also how I had a couple of history teachers here and there who took a different way of approaching American history and got into depth about things that you wouldn't have necessarily known, which was like, oh, that was fascinating. So it made me kind of a more interested in American history and the truth behind it and the complexities and the nuance and how it's There's so much to it. And then the other, it also led me to another work that's kind of like the alternate for this part, which is Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States, which I would recommend to anybody who is interested in American history. So that's the book that originally changed my perspective of really looking at how we tell our story as Americans. And eventually kind of led to Stamp for the Beginning.
You think it's the Department of Education?
Don't get me started.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wonder, like, who is the person? Who is there anyone? Should we be blaming them? But where does it go back to, do you think?
You know, in some cases, it can go back to legislation and stuff. But in other cases, it kind of goes back to the textbook companies. And there's like this whole like Pearson and these other companies that own that districts buy textbooks, and there's standards. So it's like a whole web of stuff. So it's not like you can't blame like one person for the way that curricula does not go well. And if you think about it, and I think Lowen gets into this, and I know Kendi does, the whole lost cause part of the South, of the Civil War and the whole idea of the Confederate monuments and everything, that whole philosophy that really took hold when the Klan was very big in the 20s and stuff, feeds it as well, because, like, you know, we want a good reflection of our country and stuff. So there are myriad reasons why history curriculum can be written so poorly. And I know so many teachers who really try to buck that trend and really try to show their students the genuine article, as opposed to what gets put in like a history textbook for like a paragraph on page 720, right? You know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I would only hope that more people would read it. Well, I mean, I guess we want to have a world where we wouldn't need that book.
No.
Because everything being told, you know, is the truth. But you are correct in that you said, you know, it's more about, what is it, breadth rather than depth.
Yes.
A lot of times. Because, I mean, there's so much, you know, history is constantly spreading. So how do you do that? But yeah, that's great.
Yeah. High school American history should be a 2-year course. It's hard to squeeze that much in 1 year.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of people don't know about more recent history because of it.
Yeah. I feel like they do American, like, colonial up to world, like, on repeat.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, what about these other things?
Yeah.
Because I, like, the Korean War, I've got no idea. Why were we over there? I think it was in the 50s. But that was just like, I don't remember much.
I learned more about Vietnam.
Yeah, same.
By reading comic books, watching movies, and then going into some of the history in the literature, historical literature. I learned more about World War I by reading All Quiet on the Western Front than I did in high school. Mm-hmm. And that caused me to go into World War I looking at it and stuff like that. I had a really cool history teacher in 11th grade who, instead of going chronologically, taught us about the various aspects of the Constitution and then pulled historical events to show where they intersected with historical events and things like that. So it's through that lens. So he didn't have to go chronologically. And we did a whole unit on, we did some Vietnam. We didn't talk about the My Lai massacre. We did a whole unit on Native Americans, the genocide of Native Americans in the 19th century. And then like the Native American movement of like the 70s and stuff like that. And then we did look at the robber barons and unions, the history of unions and things like that. So see, I got a little bit more than like some of the other people I know, but even then, like, yeah. Like I said, I like it how it led me to other books like The Color of Law or The Power Broker or Stamp for the Beginning, because it helps you have that conversation that we really need to have the conversation in our culture. It's like, it's an interesting conversation, you know? Yeah. And there's too many people who are so wrapped up in being afraid to be called out for some belief that they shut themselves in and don't consider, you know, I blame the internet.
That's really all we can do.
Yeah. All right. So we made it.
We did make it. Yeah. And we didn't get into a tussle.
No.
I don't think we'll be canceled.
No, I don't think we will. And we didn't overlap, which I was not. I was a little surprised. I thought we might have one, but we did not overlap. So yeah, that's really cool. All right. So I'm saving feedback until next episode. So please get that. And if you've got books that you think are like, these are the formative books for my life, for whatever reason, because you heard Stella and I talk about how they helped us discover genres. They helped us discover new perspectives on culture and history. Mm-hmm. Different methods of storytelling, whatever, drop a comment on the Facebook page or on the blog post or send us an email. We'd love to hear like what books you think of when you think of, okay, like what shaped me as who I am or what have been formative in the course of my life. But we're coming back in a month, and it's going to be Valentine's Day.
Oh dear.
And in the interest of fairness, I gave Stella Valentine's Day. So she's got the pick again. What are we going to be reading?
So thank you, Tom. I think your guilty heart finally made you make a good decision.
It grew three sizes.
Finally, I've been waiting however many years this show's been going on. So yes, now it's funny actually, if I were to take a little segue. If you recall from the episode that just came out in December, I did say that originally I wanted something super unhinged for Tom. But then, you know, I found a pretty, you know, mellow and with good themes story. But it's funny because I just texted Tom the blurb of a book, which involves reindeer shifters and a woman in Omega, and knots are involved. And I thought, if only I had found this before we recorded. Oh, but no, we're not doing that. But I did want to do, I didn't want to, because I felt like Good Spirits, you know, is not only seasonal and fiction, but it, you know, had romantic themes, obviously. So it is February and we want the romance, but I wanted something that was broader and had multiple themes again. So this book is going to have there's some romance in there, family love, love of science and knowledge, love of food, and a love of trying to make things better, I think, for everyone, but in particular the female population. This is called Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus.
All right. So come back in a month for that. Don't forget to send your feedback in. Mm-hmm. And as always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
And as Aristotle said, I think it was Aristotle. Maybe it wasn't. Oh, Socrates, I think, that the unexamined life is not worth living. So always try to get out of your ignorance and, you know, read up on something.
Yeah. Good night.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by two true freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.